still there. And I guess I ought to, previous to that, read what the official description of this morning session is. I wrote this thing a week or two ago, and I forgot to know what I told Paul we were going to do. Does anyone know where? Here, secularism. Participants will listen to a dialogue, a preacher and a secularized parishioner, and pinpoint a gospel that is intelligible yet disjunctive. Those are the two words I want to sit on. To this secular man, the lecture will be directed toward those bugged by secularity within the minds and hearts of their own church members, etc. Okay. Preacher and Cabby, take it away. I just read it and make it as real as you can. Yeah, you ought to be able to see each other. Why don't you guys back up so the preacher sit in front of me.
Yes.
Test your theory.
Sure, go ahead. I always like to talk about religion.
What would you say about Hitler and Nazism? Was that a good religion?
That was no religion.
But it had many of the characteristics of a religion. Rituals, doctrines, heritage. Most important, Hitler demanded and got total loyalty and unquestioning obedience. The institutions of Nazism replaced those of Christianity almost item by item. What does that do to your theory that every religion is good so long as you put it into practice?
Man, you sure got a crazy definition of religion.
How so?
Well, I always think of religion as, well, you know, churches and praying and preaching and, you know, that stuff.
And if you don't go to church, you're not very religious.
Well, you know, like I said, I sort of got away from it.
Maybe you did. Or maybe you just got away from a churchly kind of religion. And maybe religion could include a lot more than church. For example, what are you loyal to? What do you care about?
Oh, lots of things like, you know, like bowling. I sure like to bowl twice a week. Pretty good average, too. And 169. You bowl?
Well, Bill, what is bowling the most important thing in the world for you? Does it have your highest loyalty? Would you do anything to bowl?
No, I guess not. It's not important like that.
What are you?
I guess, well, my kids maybe. That's pretty important. He even got me to go to church for a while, you know, St. Paul's. That's how much I do for them. Once in college now, that's why I drive a cab a couple nights a week and weekends. I need the money for the kids, so I got a good enough regular job like McDonald's right out where we're going.
You do anything for your kids?
Oh, I guess so. Anything. My boy, the one in college, you know, the studying engineering, he'll be drafted when he's done. Another year. The way it looks, he'll probably have to go to Vietnam. I think I'd go for him if I had to. I was in the last war, you know, that's Germany.
That's so.
Yeah, I guess I'd do anything. Wife says I care too much. But what else has a man got to live for? No, and take my kids away, and I don't care anymore.
I don't like that. It's your religion.
I thought you were going to say that. I sort of knew that you were driving away, what you were driving at back there when you asked what I cared about. I tried to change the subject because I know what you're going to say. You're going to say I worship my kids just like the wife always says.
Well, do you?
All right, let me tell you. Yeah, I do. And it bothers me. I used to go into my rooms at night when they were little and into their rooms, and they'd be sleeping, and I'd love them so much I just could
feeling.
I knew I just couldn't stand having them suffer, and they were sick. It was worse on me than it was on them. I knew if one of them died, it would be awful. I knew I couldn't stand it. I would even pray once in a while that God wouldn't let them die. I thought going to church might help, but then there really didn't seem to be a God. Excuse me, Reverend. I don't mean to insult you.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Finally, it just seemed useless, all that singing and praying and sitting and standing by the... I'm not against religion. Good for the kids to get some starch into their lives, something to keep them straight. But I knew that if something was going to happen to them, it would. Nothing I could do, so what the hell? Excuse me, Reverend. You got me going here. I went to church often enough to please them until I got this weekend taxi job. They knew I was working for them. Keep them safe, keep them straight, give them a good education. That's all I can do. Until they get drafted and get sent to Vietnam and get shot to hell and me with them. I know that's the way it'll be. And I don't know what to do. What do I do? Oh, don't tell me to believe in God. That don't work. I tried it.
I'm not going to talk to you about God. But we can talk about religion because you have a religion. And you're practicing it right now. Driving this cab. You don't have to believe that there is a God because you already have a God, your kids. I can say even more. You use your kids to justify your life. That's what keeps you working and living.
Oh, what's wrong with that?
Why don't you tell me?
Oh, hell, don't play games with me.
I'm not really, I'm not. I think you already told me what's wrong.
When?
When you talked about how you love your kids and ended up thinking of one of them dead, maybe in a wall, and you're not able to do anything about it.
I still don't get it.
Look, Ella. The point you yourself are making is that you have a God, something that says yes to you, something that justifies your existence. Everybody who goes on living has made or found that kind of yes for life. That's why Camus.
Who?
Oh, Camus, Albert Camus.
Never heard of it.
That's all right. The point is, he said that suicide was the only important philosophical problem. If we go on living, it's because we have a God. A yes, something that affirms us. The thing you are beginning to realize is that your yes isn't all that dependable. You can't count on your kids being what you've asked them to be, your God. That's the trouble with all our religions, all our gods, all our causes and affirmations. They are not God. They are not able to be what we make them. We have to work overtime to pump life into our gods. That's what enslaves us finally. Our homemade gods always demand more than they can deliver.
But my kids are good to me. Can't ask for more.
Sure they are. Well, they can't eat a whole ball of wax. And that won't be either. It's not just Vietnam. They grow up, marry, move away from home. They need us less and less.
Yeah, that's happening already.
Besides, none of us ever succeeds in justifying our lives. Even if our gods outlast us. Death says a final no to every one of us.
Now, wait a minute. I don't look at death like that. It's just, you know, when your number is up, you bought it.
I'm not talking about how we look at death. I'm talking about the fact of death. Some people are saying that God is dead. It may really be that death is God, that death is the inescapable verdict upon each of us.
You make it sound like I'm guilty or something. But I don't really feel guilty. Nothing wrong with loving your kid.
Right. Not if that's all you're doing. But if loving them is the way you justify what you are and what you do, then you are already living an evaluated life. And then death, too, is an evaluation. It says no.
That's pretty hard to take. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask to be made this way.
That's part of my point. When we can't justify ourselves, we can always try to blame something or someone or the system itself, down with the structure. Anything to make sure that we are never in the wrong.
See, aren't you supposed to preach? Are you preachers supposed to comfort people? None of that sounds like very comforting.
Well, we started talking about religion, remember? Trying to test your theory that all religions are good as long as you practice them. I've tried to say that we all have a religion, a way of getting a yes for life, a way of not being in the wrong. And it seems to me that our religions really fail us. That we are betrayed by our religions and to deceiving ourselves and blaming others. The verdict on that kind of business is death.
You didn't say anything about God.
You said you didn't want to be told about God. So we talked about life and failure and the verdict of death. That may be all the glimpse we get of God from life and history. And the God we see there is not some grandfatherly being who makes everything come out all right in the end.
Would you guys open the circle up a little?
You yourself said that there didn't seem to be that kind of God anyway. The only God we're likely to meet if we look for one in life and history is the God that says no to life and history.
Why don't you read that last line again, because that's one of the key points, I think.
The only God we're likely to meet if we look for one in life and history is a God that says no to life and history.
But aren't you supposed to tell us the way out?
I don't think so. Whatever else I might have to say is not a way out. Christianity is not some cheap escape from the way things are. You can invent an escape if you want, but it won't take you anywhere. You can even try to make the Christian gospel into some kind of escape, but that's as much an invented religion as any other, and just as much of a failure.
Well, what is Jesus supposed to do?
He doesn't know it all. He lets us in on himself, on what he is and on what he does. He is yes to us, and he asks us to believe that and to give up our other gods and justification. His best-known stories were about himself because he was accused of saying yes to people who didn't have much going for them socially or morally or religiously, whores and traitors. He told us about a son who took his inheritance and left home.
Yeah, I know, prodigal son, right?
Yeah, the point of the story is that Jesus has a different way of dealing with rejected people. We might call it forgiveness, but it does not come cheap. Jesus' death is his final and total commitment to us. It is the way he experiences the verdict, lets it happen to him, our homemade religions, and our illustrious justifications. The boy in Jesus' story gets that kind of yes, which sets him free to admit that he is in the wrong. We are given that yes in Jesus, which sets us free to say no to our religions, even to join in the verdict from them, because the yes is stronger than the verdict. Because when the verdict has done its work, the yes overcomes it.
I never heard it that way before.
Yeah, well, that's what Christians mean by gospel. To believe the gospel means to entrust ourselves to the yes in Jesus, to hold that yes against the no of life and history. To believe Jesus is to be free for all the things in the world out of which we want to make gods, for bowling, kids, and work, and the wife. We are really free from them because we don't need any longer to try to make them what they can't be, our gods. We're not trapped into working them up into something divine. We are free to be for them as Jesus is for us.
Well, where does church and praying fit into all of this?
It helps if we stop thinking first that church is a building or a religious organization. Church is really what happens to people when the gospel is happening to them and through them to other people. The words that Christians share with one another about Jesus as God, the forgiver, are meant to set them free for one another and for all men.
Doesn't sound like any church I know.
Yeah. Maybe we all have to ask where this is really going on. It's true that a lot of religious action going on under the name of church is only a cover up for our own homemade religions. A German play written in a writer after World War II is about a man who comes back from the war and finds himself betrayed by everything. The church is a character called God in the play. The character keeps repeating, "Nobody cares about me anymore." That's what a lot of churches ask for, that people care about them. But the author shouts, "Hasn't God studied theology? Who is supposed to care about whom?" You know, when the church cares about itself and worries about whether people care about it, then that's a sure sign that the gospel is being missed somewhere. The gospel sets people free from wondering who cares about them, sets them free for caring.
You mean even church religions aren't all right when you practice them?
I'm saying that churches and doctrines and even the Bible can be misused so that they become gods and false gospels. Right religion is where Jesus' affirmation is being heard and trusted and celebrated so that men are free for each other. Wrong religion is not trusting the gospel that is in Jesus. And that kind of religion can be going on in the middle of the church.
Does praying do any good?
Yeah, like everything else, that depends on whether praying grows out of trusting the good news of Jesus. When you believe the good news, you can hold your whole life and the people in it, your world and its destiny before God. Praying then means getting to be a son of God like Jesus. That is, knowing and trusting and saying thanks for the yes that sets you free. Then you will recognize God's yes elsewhere in the world. And you will look for ways to be part of that yes in the world. Wait, there, hope.
Yeah.
Here, keep change.
Thanks. Have you ever seen Pastor X tell him hello, will you?
Well, I didn't get your name.
Well, that's all right. Just tell him about me. He'll know.
Okay. Would you two guys just bring your chairs up this part of the circle and pull it out a little bit?
To any position, he sounded non-committal or.
Would you lower a little more just so I get a little blackboard space? Okay, I'll just put him up. Uncommitted, you'd say.
Sort of like a spectator.
Okay.
Practical atheist, not in reference to God, really.
Martin, you were looking for comfort.
Religion as comfort.
He wasn't getting any, and that's why he said no to religion. Okay?
Tired of manipulation?
Tired of manipulation? I'm not quite sure yet I hear what you're saying.
Well, there was one time I remember, you know, don't play games with me.
Oh, okay. To just tick off all the virtues or vices you see in him, I want you to pinpoint what you think are signals of secularity. For example, you think pessimism is a signal of secularity? It's the secular man. Admittedly, you know, he doesn't exist as a pure type. But when you think of, you know, the secular man, is he pessimist or optimist?
It's a very, very common sight. You know, when I see this guy, I see a very, very busy person. He's so extremely busy. Doesn't have time for the business of religion. If it's put on the back burner. Successful.
Successful?
Success.
Is this, would you guys say this is successful?
No.
He's got to hold on a second job just to, you know, keep the family together, doesn't he? Or is that the market success?
Go find a man. He's got his kids in college, man. He's moving.
Well, that's not moving. Everybody's kids go to college today, don't they, Martin?
He said, quite. He's self-reliant. That comes out of the fact that he has to hang in there and keep his kids, his God.
Okay, now, right there, I think you said the most important word
to me.
Isn't he a free agent, successful, self-reliant, you know, running his own show?
Life-centered, you know, he's a kid. And to keep his
but he's also living through his kids. I mean, that's a kind of a, like somebody said, a spectator. You didn't put it up there, but
well, that was a spectator with reference to religion. He'll watch what goes on. He used to go to St. Paul's. And by the way, this dialogue did take place, as it says, right here in St. Louis, when Walt Bowman was down at CPH for some meeting or other, and he took a cab from there to the airport. There's one misprint there. It says, I got a job out of McDonald's. That's not the hamburger joint. That should be McDonald Douglas. And then he drives back on the weekend, and this dialogue took place, as the note says, almost the way it was there in the 35 minutes it took to drive from there to there. And the St. John's on the north side is, I've forgotten whose church that used to be. It looks the north side of St. Louis. Some of you St. Louisans must know. St. Paul.
Rudnick
was his parish. Rudnick is the pastor X he's talking about. Bill Rudnick of St. Paul. I mean, before you say Paul.
We've got to get a kid to school or else he's going to feel like he's nothing. He's dead and he doesn't know why. Well, he's got to hang in there.
He doesn't know why. That sounds like typical preacher talk. If you ask if you're dead, you don't know why. You say, hell, man, what are you talking about? I'm liver and you are, you know. Don't give me that preacher talk. What do you mean when you say? What do you mean when you say I'm dead and I don't know why? Well, let's role play.
He's really trying to find something, you know, to make his life meaningful, to make his existence meaningful.
Okay.
He's finding it in his kids, but he really wants it and doesn't, you know, isn't being fully fulfilled that way.
Well, who or what? Let's just zero in on this. You used another synonym for this has to. He's got to. Who or what is the thing that's twisting this guy's arm and compelling him? Who or what's the compulsion behind these has to and behind these got us? What would you say?
What's this?
Well, I would say that there are some basic fears there. Some basic wavelengths he's getting from his environment that says that, you know, we're living in a time where everything does not want to stay in its place. And he's trying to come to grips with this as he sees it affecting his life. The mobility of his life is taking his kids away to college in Vietnam. The political arena is eroding his family life away. And in a number of fronts, he feels he has to come to grips with all this. It's really almost overwhelming. It's too much for him to come to grips with. And that's why he has to. He has to, he's got it because he's got no damn other body that's going to care enough to help him do it.
Okay. Is that very graphic last sentence characteristic of the secular man? There's pressures on, well, just take the last sentence, but the preceding sentence. There are pressures on me that I feel, and damn it, either I got to come through or nobody else is going to. I'm asking you to read your own, you know, parish and personal experience. Is that a common denominator, perhaps even a universal one, of the American man on the street and woman and high school kid and who knows what? What would you say? Let's just zero in on that for a minute, but not go any further for the moment. But let's just see if we can open that one up to see if you think that's today's secular man.
Well, this world is so bad, and he's got to do it, and nobody's going to do it for him. He doesn't do it. Nobody's going to give him anything. He's got to make it for himself.
I got it because no one else will do it. No one else will.
Would anyone want to? You know, I'm not putting that up because I think it's right. I gather that's kind of consensus. But if it's not consensus with you, would you suggest how you think maybe ought to be varied a little bit or modified? Which of the fancy big words over here does that reflect? Yeah, literally the word autonomy is, you know, myself, the Greek word autos, has to do the ruling, the nomos, the running of my life, because if I don't, nobody else will. Or no thing else will. These four words I put up there while the dialogue was going on are four that Langdon Gilkey likes to use as terms that what he calls thematize the experience of secular man. Now, thematize is a big 25-cent word too, but that puts into language the feelings and experiences that we have. You know, we get our feelings and experiences unlanguaged.
but with our own head or with the language we've learned, we've somehow put it into words. And once we put it into words, we say to ourselves, I can make sense out of it, you know, if I can kind of put it into words. And if you can put it into words, you can talk about it with somebody else then, too. So being able to thematize experience, thematize stuff that happens to you, allows for two things. One, makes you capable of sort of understanding it, at least to manage it intellectually, to get a hold of it so you can at least think about it. And it makes it possible for you to share, to talk with somebody else about it. Do you see, even though I won't go into definitions at the moment of these other three, do you see places where the cabbie, where these words thematize the cabbie's experience as he sort of unpiled it with the creature?
Well, the transients, he found meaning in St. Paul's for a while, maybe find meaning in his kids for a while. Maybe he'll find meaning after his kids are gone in something else. Maybe he'll bowl more, or maybe he'll buy a house in the shore and keep that up. But nothing really is permanently meaningful.
Okay, now you're saying nothing permanently is meaningful. And in fact, I gather by that you mean none of the values that he likes to hang on to last very long. Are you saying that he is shifty? He hangs on to this for a while, and then he lets go of that, and hangs on to this, and then lets go of that, and hangs on to that?
In a way, in that these things don't continue to give him meaning. His kids grow up, and they pass out of his existence. He's got to find something else.
Okay.
How did he get that way? And
how did he get
that way? I have a Messiah complex. That guy is the guy I find him as a bartender, he runs the bowling alley, or he's a cop, or he lives in my town, in a cabbie. And I usually wind up spending, you know, all kinds of stupid hours in the middle of the night with that guy.
Now, what's your question?
I'm going to put it this way. I always feel like, in some way, I am responsible for that guy being that way. You know, he's a shallow man. He watched, you know. Was he confirmed, or, you know, where did I find this guy? Either he was confirmed in my parish 30 years ago, and, you know, he didn't pay any attention to the preacher through him the ladder, or he married one of our daughters, and he went through my premarital counseling 20 years ago, or his kid was baptized because his mother-in-law belonged to our church. And I had a crack at that guy.
And you blew it. Or somebody.
Or somebody. You know, I'm in the process of creating him for somebody else 10 years from now.
Well, I'd like to bracket your question out just for 5 minutes before we move into the preacher here. But to just give me a little more clarity. Now, I gather one of the things you're saying to sort of my project one, let's look at this guy a little more closely, is to say there's a sense in which official religion has helped create him.
Yeah.
At least you think so.
Yeah.
Either the preachers he ran to in the past, or the parochial school teachers, the Sunday school teachers, or just that lousy congregation.
Which
maybe was a good congregation.
Rudnick
was one of the great pastors in St. Louis, from what I hear. I wasn't around then. I'm hung up on my three other words. Does anybody see any place where the phenomenon, go back to what you were saying. I think that he doesn't just say, I shift. As though, you know, he's not a theological nymphomaniac who says, you know, I shack up with this God for a while, but then I get tired, I move to another one, and I move to another one. But the things he hangs on to themselves trickle away, especially the kids. You know, the boy go to Vietnam, get shot to hell, and me with him. And there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do to make that object that I'm hanging on to permanent. I can't make it permanent. And in the sense in which the feedback is, its permanency then has feedback on me. Do you see any place where, just to take that last line I gave you, where he reflects his awareness that the feedback of impermanence is also telling him, hey, cabbie, you ain't very permanent either. In other words, passing a judgment back on him, not just saying, hey, man, the gods you're hanging on to, they're kind of under a kind of judgment. They won't live.
Well, when the preacher says, well, our God don't answer.
Okay. Well, and the whole discussion of, you know, death is a final no to all of us, a judgment on us. And when your boy gets shot to hell, there's a sense in which, as you said, and me with him, you're being shot to hell. That boy is a big piece of your life. You know, it's like saying, this was me, and then he got shot to hell, and that much got knocked out. You know, there's sort of there's a big hole there, but that hole is me, even though it's, you know, the body of my son. But I am not just, as Ortega y Gasset said, I am not just that which you find inside my skin. I am me plus all my relationships. All of that is who I am. And you rip off one of these relationships and you've ripped off a piece of a traitor, even though, you know, what's inside his skin may not have been touched. Relativity. All these two words are almost synonymous, are almost parallel, but the way Gilkey works them, I think, is of some difference. The transience refers to just that, you could use the word temporality. Things exist for a time, but time passes, and boy, they pass. And so death gets into the mix here at this experience of transience. I'm going to keep pumping that word for a few minutes, experience. This is not a head trip dialogue initially between the preacher and the cabbie. What the cabbie starts doing, and the preacher, you know, coaxes him a little bit, but the preacher doesn't really put many words in his mouth, if at all, but just says, hey man, tell me more. Or hey, did you look at this and this? Now look at that. What do you think? What did you see? What do you feel? Tell me how it hits you. You know, he says, oh hell, don't play games with me. The guy says, I'm not playing games. You're telling me the way you feel. The lived experience, the lived feelings, is what this cabbie gives us an awful lot of. We don't see much of his intellectual reflection. But he does put into words this experience of transience, which, under the preacher's guidance, is focused on the big no, and no as judgment. Autonomy, we've seen at least a smidgen of that, in that he's got to make it work, or otherwise no one else is going to take care of him. The opposite of relativity, transience would be permanence or even eternity, something that lasts forever. The opposite of relativity is what? Let's just get the terminological opposite up here on the board.
I think absolute is normally the definite. I couldn't think of it a moment ago. I wasn't playing games. And contingency is necessity. These are, you know, philosophical terms.
Where do you see him finding little experience of anything absolute, but experience that he could take relativity, little experience of this, but experience of things he felt that? I'm pushing you fast, and I should spend more time on that.
We're evaluating life as he sees it on the basis of the way he sees it, essentially. Huh?
Well, let me put it this way. What I hear him saying is, there's nothing in my experience that I perceive that is necessarily so. That has to be that way because of, you know, some divine plan, or because God is in the heavens and therefore all's right with the world. Everything seems contingent, you know. It could have happened this way, or it could have happened that way. My boy can get drafted because accidentally he's got number one in the draft lottery instead of number 360 in the draft lottery. And there's no apparent necessary plan that lets me see, sure enough, that's the way it had to be, and that's the way it had to be. Everything seems to be, you know, just like this. Chance. You throw it up and you know it's going to come down, but you know it can come down anywhere, you know, from that square way over to there, and 95% will come down there, and there. This experience of the chanciness of everything in the world, or at least of so much of your life. And then the relativity that when anything does happen in any particular way, the reason it happened that way was because of other relatively accidental factors. Contingency and relativity are fairly similar, but the way you explain them, you say, well, if I hadn't left home, you know, 5 minutes late for the office, I wouldn't have been rushing so fast to get in the car, and I'd have been a little more careful going around that curve, and I wouldn't have bent the fender on that guardrail. That's the way all of you people, I bet, explain when you get a dented fender to your wife or to your friend. You, the people in this room, use these ways of making sense out of your experience, even though you're the theoretical religionist leaders. When's the last time you said, well, that's just the way the ball bounces? Or that's just the way the cookie crumbles? That's the contingency thing. It says there's no reason why it had to be that way, but just in this particular case, that's just the way it happened.
If I hadn't married that woman,
how many times did you guys say that? Or relativity. How do you people explain Mr. Nixon's mess right now? I bet every one of you, when you explain it, does it in terms of relativity. He did this, or he did that, or he hired Magruder, or he hired so-and-so, and he hired so-and-so. Because of those relative factors, it went that way. I bet none of you describes it with any kind of God language to your kids.
to your wife, or even to yourself, that you interpret your own experience, big chunks of it at least, in these kind of categories. And how often haven't you already said, well, pretty soon the public will get tired of all that Watergate stuff.
Yeah.
It'll pass away. This too shall pass away. And I don't know how you experience and interpret your own selves autonomously, but my guess is that many of you are saying, if you think you're at a position in the church now, that at least part of the reason you got that way is because, by golly, you may have had luck. That's contingency. Or else you really put yourself to work and you earned your way into this job, because, boy, if you don't take care for yourself, nobody else will, at least not very often. And, of course, you tell the congregation, well, it's by the grace of God I got where I am, but... but what do you tell yourself? Now, I'm not trying to put you all down. What I want to do is to, first of all, have you people realize that the guy in the back seat of that cab, if that guy is you, is also, in large respect, also in the front seat. In terms of the way you interpret your own daily experience. Well, the hour is screaming toward the end. Let's just move over for a minute and take a look at Walt Bowman, the preacher, in this one. How does the preacher try to be God's witness to the cabbie? Could you just kind of probe and poke to see where you see him either practicing techniques, or where you see, sure enough, here's kind of a principle he's working with, or an idea he's apparently trying to drive home, or just a praxis skill?
He explodes the false gods.
He explodes the false gods. Do you think that's true?
We have to work overtime to come life into our gods.
Okay, who explodes the false gods? That's what I'm leaning for.
He's lazy, right?
Excuse me, I keep looking to you guys because I'm basically leaning to the right. Just to show that I can be all things to all men. Somebody over here would...
I forgot what I was going to tell.
If you don't, the cabbie will.
I think the preacher's letting the cabbie.
Yeah, he's just, you know, bringing in the stuff in the arena so this guy can really go to the end of what he's saying, conclude what he says.
Okay, well, let me just say, now all of this and maybe all of that is at the moment our sort of sketch of what the cabbie's experience is as he dumps it out. What does the preacher do with this bunch?
He just makes him follow through on it.
Okay.
Sure. Well, that's kind of where I picked up. I kind of do name the thought. Put a big sign up in front of this guy, trying to get him to stop. And when the guy is forced into a position where you've got to try to think it and pull things together a little bit, the guy is.
Okay. In terms of his own experience, the preacher often just acts as a mirror, as a sounding board. He lets it hit, and he rephrases it occasionally, or he'll say, hey, you threw me one beam a minute ago, and here's another beam. Now put those two beams together. But you put them together. You put them together. Let me help you interpret your life with a goal toward what, though? What do you think the preacher... Where's the preacher trying to drive the guy just in terms of interpreting this bag?
He's trying to look out, look some... To see... To cause him to see that he needs to look somewhere else.
Okay, but I'm not. That's too fast.
He's religious.
Well, I think in the preacher's.
Yeah, he's trying to get him to see the no. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. For the moment, let's just use that. You know, the diagram on this sermon is pretty. On this sermon, on this sermonic dialogue, is very simple. It's yes and no in a taxi cab.
Yeah.
The cabbie supplies the data on which the preacher helps him see the big no that's in that data. Could we just unpack that a little bit yet? Where so or how so does the preacher dig out the no, which the cabbie has already
gotten? Well, simply left to the kind of questions which leads this man out to the logical conclusions of the position that up to this time he's taken. And apparently, Bolden's duties of the preacher in this case, the clergyman, that that these things will finally bring to a dead end student. They're not satisfactory solutions to the problem. And he simply asked the kind of questions, as I think, which makes this guy hold this for himself right after the end when he stopped the 85 up and left.
Yeah, but there's more intellectual about it. It's deeper than an intellectual. I mean, I don't know if you said that carelessly or not, but this is not an intellectual process.
No, but he's using an intellectual.
Well, he's
making the guy come to the logical conclusions of where he's at.
If the preacher's got a blueprint in his head at all, what would you think the blueprint would read at this point?
what I should do with the cabbie during the first 20 minutes of the ride.
Bring him to talk about any see and feel transients of
Can anyone see how the preacher is working very consciously with a Book of Concord Lutheran theology right in the point we're trying to work out right now? Why could only a Lutheran at least do this consciously?
Well, I can see he's working on the law.
I can see two things. There's no doubt that the preacher sees that there's a better way.
Okay, well, every preacher would do that. Any Christian who had even a snippet of faith would say, man, I got something better than this.
Okay, good. But in a gospel context,
what is he
doing? He's working with law.
Of the life he's living, of the gods he has.
Can anybody pinpoint an arch-Lutheran piece? I'm just going to be, you know, my job is systematic theology. I've got to see if there's any hope for my discipline yet amongst the clergy. Anybody know any place in the Book of Concord where Bowman is almost quoting verbatim, chunk for chunk for chunk? First commandment, large catechism. What does it mean to have a God? To have a God is to hang your heart on any object. It doesn't have to be a divine or a spiritual thing or a supernatural thing. Anything that you hang your heart on from which you get the vibes. That's Revised Schrader version. From which you get the resources you need so that you can live your life now, where you run when the chips are down and then you got to scramble, from what you expect good, and where you finally get a good word that says you're a good boy in some sense. The classic old Mother Goose rhyme for this is Little Jack Horner sat in the corner eating his Christmas pie, stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum. And what did he say? He didn't say, man, that's a good pie. He said, what a good boy am I? The feedback is to interpret your experience so that you get strokes, you know, so that you get justification. Well, all of this is big, hearty, hitty Reformation theology here. And what the preacher does is, in effect, he doesn't say, man, I want to prove to you that there's a God. And I guess Luther would say, no Lutheran ought to do that, ever. You should say, man, it's my presupposition that you've already got one, two, or maybe a dozen gods going for you. And you probably don't call them divine, and in your case, they aren't divine. They're creatures rather than the creator. They may be great and powerful creatures, too. Money, sex, success are great and powerful creations in the cosmos. But my hunch is that you are already experiencing what I know will be true. That anyone who makes a creature rather than the creator his God is not going to get enough that he needs to survive, to roll with whatever the punches are. And especially if the big punch that every sinner confronts, here's the Lutheran bag again, is what? What's the biggest punch for which you need resources to roll with?
Well,
yeah, but be more biblical about it now, like we were a couple days ago. What's so animosity-ish about his last enemy?
That's the end.
That's worse than that.
No.
Yeah, you encounter, every sinner finally encounters God when you bump into death, and it's the God of judgment. You know, the Psalm 90 stuff I read to you a couple days ago. You, God, turn us to death, and you send us back to the dust. For our sins, you are revexed, and you wipe us out. So the biggest nemesis, this preacher apparently knows, that everyone confronts is finally not just death, the wipe out, the end, but the judgment and wrath of God that, if it never gets you before, will finally get you at the moment of your death, or at least at the death of your boy. Or in this case, you know, the guy's boy hasn't died, but the fear of his boy dying is already, you know, ripping a chunk of his life out. So what you need to encounter, the big no is not just death, the big no is the judgment of your own creator in that death. Now, where in the cosmos is there anything you can get hold of to hold up against that needle? Heaven and earth? Anything in heaven and earth? Jesus himself said will pass away. So that stuff ain't judgment proof. Nothing in the creation that you can hang on to is judgment proof. You know, immune to God's needle. So no matter what, how big or how little the fig leaf is that you hide behind, Adam 3, or Genesis 3, Adam. Movie house up here, which has got that great Bergman film on death that you ought to go see if you got a few bucks and a couple hours yet, Cries and Whispers. And that's Esquire 1, Esquire 2, Esquire 3. Notice how I justify myself? There's no fig leaf that will break the divine needle unless it be the Christ of God who has in his own body on the cross broken the divine needle of criticism. And with that, let's...
that push over. How does the preacher preach gospel to this guy? In admittedly, you know, very narrow compass, and just over the back seat all the over the back of the front seat all the time. Can you see any principles, I shouldn't say principles, any practical procedures? If you had to do an analysis of how the preacher proclaims Christ to the guy, what would be some of the things you might, how would you thematize it?
Well, here's the thing, he is yes to it.
Okay.
When Jesus lets himself in on his life, or into his life, that remark.
And if the diagnosis has focused on, you know, one of the shortest words in the English language, how does the, well, I guess it's obvious, but what I want to say is he makes the Christological proclamation in language that fits the diagnosis language, although to be sure it's the exact opposite. At the outset, I used the word intelligible disjunctive, or it's written in the book. Disjunctive, by disjunctive I mean, I guess I should take it account. Intelligible means that you're talking your Jesus talk in at least words and pictures that the guy whom you're talking to can say, that registers. I at least can understand what you're talking about. And understand in the sense that what you're talking about, the Jesus you're talking about, you know, clicks in to lived experience. Even though my lived experience was negative, or at least, you know, the way we worked it, it came out negative. But at least what you're talking about is not head trippy stuff. Is not just intelligentsia, is not all that crap about Camus and all those, you know, philosophers and whatnot. So that's the intelligible word. The gospel is framed in language that links to the lived experience. But it's disjunctive, and yet it says that what the preacher is giving him there is something that he hasn't had in this bag. And it's not just another form of what's in his bag. It's a kind of good news that is different from even some of the good news that he has in his bag. You know, couldn't want better kids. I had great fun bowling, and apparently his wife's a good gal. At least he doesn't gripe about his marriage. So there are pluses over here in his experience. But the plus over here is a completely bigger or qualitatively different plus, because this plus really meets some of the ouches here. And all those little pluses still didn't succeed in meeting where it hurt. And he admitted that himself. You know, our God's got play feet. Can't be the whole ball of wax. They don't work. Okay, I think that's sort of the major, if I'd say, blueprint piece. That's kind of the I can only think of a farmer word now, the axle tree. Any of you farmers know what an axle tree is? That holds both wheels together on an old farm wagon. What else do you see procedurally? How is the preacher proceeding to witness to a secular man? You know, that's kind of the axiom one that we're talking about today.
He lets him talk and lay out his life and his experiences. He doesn't lay on something on top of him.
Except when he's talking gospel, he sure does, doesn't he? Does he have the cabbie say, hey man, you know the gospel, why don't you tell me?
Okay, the gospel though comes out to be intelligible, like you said, in that into his system and doesn't, you know, put a lot of big theological system.
Okay. Do you ever find him telling the cabbie, hey man, at that point you're wrong, I got to correct your thinking?
Never.
Did you notice that? He never tells the cabbie, man, you've got it all screwed up. Why do you think he does that?
Because the man, he would.
Is that just a tactic that he'd say, man, for tactical purposes, I don't dare ever say no to the guy because immediately he'll turn off and pull the screen down and Zach will never talk anymore.
Because I'm law going already.
Unpack that, Martin. I think that's the point.
Well, the man is down, he is out, he is groping, he's grasping, and he doesn't have to have any more pile on him. He needs somebody to pull him up, pick him up, say, you're okay. Don't quit fighting, you're all right like you are. No point in telling him he's all wet. He knows that, I think.
Now, my point is not whether he knows he's all wet. My point is, the guy, you know, lays out a working theology. Someone says he's a practical atheist. That just means he's practical non-theist with reference to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he's a very practical theist in terms of his alternative God. Except they're crumbling, and so he's scrambling all the time for them.
And you and I would say, my gosh, he's got a false God, he's got false theology, you know, everything is false in that sense. Why doesn't the preacher nail him for all that false theology stuff?
I don't think he has to.
Well, okay, maybe I just want to expand on what Martin was saying.
Yeah, I don't think he has to. The guy, I think there's no indication that he says, okay, I'll make sure that my theology is something better, but I think he says to me that there is something better, and then he realizes he's down inside himself, maybe not even so, you know, that this just, it works. He can make it work. There's a workability to it, but it certainly doesn't work satisfactorily. And
okay.
It leaves a lot of things to be desired, certainly down in his gut. And he senses that this guy has an angle on this that may be useful. He's open, he's ready for a better way. It's kind of like the advertising. They never said the other guy's car never works at all. It is literally the better idea. It's
okay.
And so he seems to be coming that way.
The big bag of self-concern that the guy has, and the pastor is, in emphasizing the freedom, is setting him free from that self-concern.
Okay, but there I hear you once more saying, you know, he's got self-concern and that's wrong. And the pastor doesn't come out. Let me, the axe I'm grinding right now is, the reason you would have trouble if you would say, hey man, you got it all wrong, if you tried that, is you'd say, hell man, what are you talking about? That's my experience. What do you mean my experience is wrong? You know, that's what hits me every day. So that there's a big element of, you know, the word true is written all over this bag here too. You know, I do feel like that when I think about my son going to Vietnam. Now, you may tell me I ought not feel that way, but I don't, whether or not I ought to, it's true, I do feel that way. You may tell me that I ought not be scrambling like this, but this is the only way I can make sense out of my life. So at that point, the preacher, in a sense, is acknowledging the truthfulness of the cabbie's own self-description of his lived experience. In fact, the preacher even pushes him to say, hey, man, you want to get at the deeper truth of it? You could write one big two-letter word over the whole schmear, and I bet you experience that, don't you? You probably never quite said it that way, but check it out once more. Isn't that true? And so that the counsel he gives him is not that he says, hey man, run over here and run out of this and just jump out of this bag. But in effect, he says, hey man, let this yes be written right over top of this bag. And when he talks Jesus, and to be sure, it's just real skimpy. It's on the last page, the first column. He doesn't say, hey Jesus, we'll tell you how you can escape all that stuff. In fact, you know, the preacher says, aren't you supposed to help to get us a way out? And the preacher says, first of all, you know, that ain't the way the gospel is. You've never heard a gospel like that before. But to take a look if you've got it. The last page, right over here on this column, you just got two paragraphs. My students often criticize Bowman for having too chintzy a gospel there, but I think he at least tries to pack it all in this little dialogical thing, and he's packed the big gospel, where he says, the point of the story, and he's picking up prodigal son, is that Jesus is a different way of dealing with rejected people. I mean, people who are already under God's own know. Remember, the people Jesus dealt with were sinners. They weren't just people that the Pharisees said are bad people. They were people that God said are lawbreakers and covenant breakers. A different way of dealing with rejected people. We might call it forgiveness, but it does not come cheap. Jesus' death is his final and total commitment to us. It is the way he experiences the very blessed that happened to him, our homemade religions, and illusory justification. In this kind of picture, just stop there a minute. The gospel is presented as, you know, Jesus is the one who came right into the same bag you're in, man. Including the bag of being under the verdict of God himself, finally. You know, Jesus cries on the cross as though that's what he's experiencing. My God, why are you thumbs downing it with me? And then he, in a sense, that's sort of the Good Friday paragraph. Admittedly, it's condensed and telescoped. And then comes the Easter Sunday paragraph, the next one. The boy in the story gets that kind of yes, which sets him free to admit that he's in the wrong. We are given that yes in Jesus, which sets us free to say no to our religions, even to the point of joining the verdict upon them, because the yes is stronger than the no verdict. Because when the verdict has done its worst, Good Friday, the yes overcomes it, Easter Sunday. So that if the Jesus we're talking about had just stayed under the verdict of death, then there wouldn't be any good news for him or for us. But his resurrection is not the statement that says, hey, Good Friday was false, it didn't really happen, or it was a mistake. It says, you bet Good Friday is true, but Easter Sunday trumps it. Man, your experience of being under God's needle, or being under our Vietnam's needle, or whatever needle, is true. But God's victory in Christ trumps even that.
And that's the very nature of the gospel.
Hey, right on!
That's a denial to a firmer person, and maybe he is, and what he's asking, get away, maybe we'll let know and bring an affirmation, and that's one of the reasons
the hour's up, but we're perhaps not just to the point where we could have now some real good discussion. I didn't want to push it as fast as I did, but now at least you've heard the way I think this little dialogue reveals the secular man in a way to preach the gospel. Maybe not the only way, but I think a very effective way that doesn't cheat on the gospel, doesn't cheat on the Lutheran confession of commitment and its insight about man and false gods and the need for justification, and lets Jesus Christ be seen in one of the simplest words. You know, that's about as simple a kind of language as you can preach gospel in, a yes and a no. You know, that's the big word, justification and sanctification, although the substance of those words is implicit in what this says. In the last column, you know, the preacher does spell out a little ecclesiology. What is the church? The church is those people who have heard the yes and are living under it and passing the yes off to other people this year.